So I'm excited to tell you guys about what's amped up about what I'm learning in my life through scripture. And I'm going to talk about three different stories, and I'm going to tell you my story. I'm going to give you some life application through what's going on with me these days. But we're going to start with the woman at the well. So if you will turn to John 4, 1 through, well, that's the woman at the well story, is John 4, 1 through 42. We won't read that whole thing, but there are going to be some times. I'm going to paraphrase a lot of it, and then there's going to be a couple times when we do read from the Word. I have an NIV. This is the Bible my dad gave me when I was 16, and I can't not use it. So I'm sorry if her translations are different. Sorry about that. Sorry, not sorry. Okay, so the woman at the well, Jesus and his disciples have been baptizing and the baptizing people, and the Pharisees have heard about it, and they're not pleased. And so they leave Judea. Jesus is like, okay, guys, this is our exit. We need to not be here anymore because they're getting mad. And they go to Galilee. Well, they have to stop in Samaria on the way there, and they come to a town in Samaria. I'm not going to try and pronounce the name. And Jesus is tired, so he finds himself sitting by a water well. And the disciples go into town for food, and this woman comes to the well, and Jesus sees her, and he says, "Will you please give me a drink?" And she's like, "Are you talking to me?" Because Jewish people don't talk to Samaritans. They're considered unclean, and there's all these ceremonies that they have to go through to get clean again, so they just rather not talk to them. But he's talking to her, and she says, "Your people don't talk to me. Are you sure you're talking to me?" And Jesus says, "If you only knew who you were talking to, you'd be asking me for living water." And so she's thinking, okay, this guy's probably a little mentally unstable, because not only is he talking to me, but he's like talking about how he's going to give me water. And she says, how are you going to give me water? You don't have anything to get water with out of this well. And Jesus says to her, "The water that I have, this water will fill you up, but you'll just be thirsty again. The water I have for you will quench your thirst for eternity." And then he says to her, "Go get your husband and come back to me, and we'll talk about it some more." And she says, in John 4:17, "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have said is quite true." And I'm sure with big eyes, she's like, okay, I get it. You're a prophet. I get it. And Jesus, and a couple more scriptures down, helps her understand that he's not just a prophet, he's the Messiah. And the disciples come back, and so there's the scene, Jesus and the woman, and Jesus just told her everything about herself. She's a Samaritan, and the disciples come up, they have their food, and they see them, and I'm sure, like, nobody says a word. But they're thinking, what is he doing talking to her? And Jesus is just like, yeah, I'm talking to her. He didn't say that, but they're all saying it with their eyeballs, I'm sure of it. And she says, she doesn't say anything either, but she's thinking, we've been caught. They know that he's not supposed to be talking to me. He just told me everything about myself. He's a prophet. He claims he's the Messiah. She turns around. She goes back to town. That we do know. She goes back to town. So on her way back to town, I can only imagine what she's thinking. She's like, oh my gosh, I have got to tell somebody about what just happened to me. Because this guy knew things about me. He says he's the Christ. And then what? Then I'm sure her next thought might be, I'm just pretending like I'm her in my brain, is, who am I going to tell? Who am I going to tell? It was a difficult task for her to do, to go back and tell the others about what had just happened to her. Number one, she could have been lying because Jews don't talk to Samaritans. Number two, she's a woman, not so much a woman-friendly time, especially women who have had five husbands and their current boyfriend that she's living with is not, she's not married to him, and that was like a big deal for them. And so she's in this town, her hometown, wanting to tell people. My dad calls her the first missionary, wanting to tell people what just happened to her, who she just maybe encountered. And it's scary, and it's hard, and it's a challenge, and she could have very easily not done it, but she did it. And she said, guys, John 4:39-42 is what she says. Oh, sorry, my Bible's not being my friend right now. Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Christ? She said it. She said the hard thing. A woman with that had no business talking to anybody and saying something that could have been a lie. She did it. And the next verse is like my favorite part of it. It's like her reward comes quick. They came out of the town and made their word their way toward him. She did a very hard thing, and people became believers. They could have mocked her, they could have ignored her, they could have been angry at her, but they came and they saw and they believed. Her task wasn't all for naught. I'm going to go ahead and finish from John 4:39. Many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did. So when the Samaritans came to him, they urged him to stay with them, and he stayed 2 days. Because of his words, many more became believers. They said to the woman,
we no longer believe just because of what you said. Now we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world. She did a hard thing, you guys. She did a really hard thing. And instantly, she had her payoff. So now we're going to go to the Old Testament, and we're going to talk about Jonah. So, I'll give you some time to go ahead and get to Jonah. It's in the Old Testament. I think it's like only 4 chapters long. So it's one of those baby ones. If you want to go to the front, it's 4 chapters. If you want to go to the front and look in your, I had to do this. I had to go to the front of my Bible and look in the concord, or the, what's that called, table of contents? And I had to figure out where Jonah was in my Bible too, because it's, if you're flipping through it, it's just gonna go by fast. Okay, so in Jonah, God tells him, go to Nineveh. A kid song that I like. And God's saying, go to Nineveh because they used to worship me, they don't worship me anymore, they've become wicked. And Jonah doesn't want to go. He had so badly that he heads in the opposite direction, and he goes to Tarshish. That's hard to say. Tarshish. And once, to get to Tarshish, he's going to take a boat. And once at sea, the sea starts to become rough, and a violent storm threatens to break up the ship. And all the men were throwing their cargo overboard, and all worshiping and saying prayers of mercy, like, help us, save us, to their gods. And the storm's still a-rocking. And Jonah is sleeping below deck, and the captain goes to him and says, how are you sleeping through this? Like, get up and beg your God to save us. We've all done it. It's your turn, buddy. And all of the other people on the ship are like, no, let's cast lots. So my concordance tells me that a way that they cast lots was with pebbles or with sticks. So we don't know which one that they did in this certain situation, but just for visual effect in your mind's eye, we're going to pretend like they were drawing straws, okay? And this is how the people of the day decided that their gods would show truth, was by casting lots. So they all had sticks, and they were all the same length except for one was short, and Jonah got the short one, so that meant his God was the one that was mad at them. And so they're like, dude, who are you? Like, and Jonah had already told them that he was running away from the Lord. And they're like, what'd you do? Who are you? And Jonah has to say, I'm a Hebrew. I worship the God who made the sea and land. And they were like, well, what should we do? And Jonah says, you're going to have to throw me overboard. And they're like, no, we don't want to do that, because that might anger your God more. So they just try rowing back to shore. It doesn't work. And so then they're like, okay, we're going to have to throw you in. So they throw Jonah in, and instant calm. The sea has instant calm. So what I'm learning from this story in my life right now is that, Jonah 1:15. Then they took Jonah and threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. At this, the men greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. In the midst of Jonah's struggle, of Jonah's hard task, of something that God had asked Jonah to do, and he was in the middle, smack dab in the middle of actively trying to rebel against God, people saw God and worshiped him. It was a difficult task for Jonah to get to Nineveh. He was actively disobedient. He had to tell them to throw him in, and he didn't really learn his lesson. The rest of Jonah's story is he didn't learn his lesson. So he gets thrown in the water, he gets in the belly of a big fish, whale, and then he's like, I'm sorry, God, I'll do what you told me to do. And so the big fish spits him out, and he goes to Nineveh, and he says, yo, God's going to kill you guys if you don't turn from your wicked ways. Again, a paraphrase. And they're like, okay, let's do it. Let's do it. And Jonah's like, what? Like, you're really going to obey God now? And they say, yeah. And so they all put on sackcloth and ashes, and they ask God to forgive them. And Jonah's like, that's a nice show you're putting on, fellas, but God's not going to forgive you. But God forgave them. And Jonah goes out of the city, and he waits for God to smite them. And God's like, sorry, Jonah, I'm God. I get to decide who I save. You don't get to decide who I save. And so that's the story. That's the reason why we have Jonah in the Bible. That's his lesson that he needed to learn. But in the midst of his struggle, in the midst of his struggle, he was still able to bring people to God. Jonah had a task that wasn't even over, and he's in the middle of it, and others came to know God. He was running away. His running away wasn't all for naught. So now we're going to go to Jesus in the garden. Matthew 26, 39. Jesus is in the garden. Jesus and his disciples go to Gethsemane. Whoa, I can usually say that. Gethsemane. There we go. He asks them to sit and pray and to not fall into temptation. And then Jesus goes and he prays. Oh, I asked you guys to turn there, but I forgot to turn. There we go. And he prays. So, Matthew 26, 39. Going a little farther, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yes, yet not as I will, but as you will." Jesus goes back to his disciples, and they're sleeping. And Jesus tells them, "Get up, like, help me, please. Be my friends in this moment." Pray and don't fall into temptation. And Jesus goes back to pray by himself. 26:42. Matthew 26:42. He went away a second time and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible for this cup to be taken away, unless I drink it, may your will be done." Jesus saying, "Please, please don't make me do this. Is there another way? If there's another way, let's do that way." Like, he doesn't want to go to, I mean, he wants there to be a salvation story, but he doesn't want to have, he knows what's before him. He knows the struggle that is coming his way, and that's death on a cross in, like, the most cruel manner. And he's like, he doesn't want to do it. Jesus came back to his disciples, and they were asleep again. And this time he doesn't even bother to wake them. He just leaves them. 26:42. He says, he went away a second, 44. In 26:44, he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. I mean, he was sick to his stomach. He had so much sorrow to the point of death that he did not want to have to do what he knew was about to happen. And he tells the disciples that the hour is near. He's arrested, and then he's crucified. And what I've learned from this story is that Jesus felt alone in his struggle. And he keeps asking not to have to do it. And he knew what was coming. And Jesus' task was dying, knowing that he had to die for us to all be able to live together. A part of his prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane is found in John, and I'm just going to quickly go to it and read it. You don't have to flip to it in your Bible unless you want to. I'm going to read John 17:20-21. "My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one. Father, just as you are in me, and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me." Jesus prayed in the garden so that the world may believe. Jesus dying on the cross wasn't what he wanted to do in the garden, but his death was not all for naught. The world has a Savior, and we have hope. So, from these Bible stories, the real life application for this in my life starts with me telling you about how I was a basketball player. I started in sixth grade. Yeah, that's my technology, right? I looked a little bit like that. A little more straightened out, but I played basketball from sixth grade into college. And when I started in sixth grade, I was tall for my age. I was like shoulders and heads above all the other girls my age. And so everybody just kind of instantly praised me for being a good basketball player just because I was tall, because that meant if you're tall, it means you're good. At that age, for sure. And I was kind of naturally athletic. That's how God made me. Like, I have a good center of balance and was pretty coordinated. And so I was good at that, and I understood the game pretty well. And it was a chance for praise and attention. And so I just stuck with it. And I was good at it. And I was in a good school district that had like feeder teams, and the high school that I would eventually feed into had an amazing program with a not so amazing coach, but I guess people liked him because, you know, he won championships for our school. And basketball was like a big deal to me. It was a way for me to connect with my dad. It was just, and I was just good at it. I didn't really have to put a lot of effort into it. I was just good at it. When I got to college, there was people who were better than me. And I was like, well, that's whatever. And then I went to another college, and there was more people who were better than me. And I was like, I mean, I guess second string's fine. I mean, I'm just still getting to play the game, but not all of the praise and attention that I was used to was coming to me. And after a while, I just gave up. I was just like, yeah, I don't think I want to do basketball anymore, because in my brain, I internalized that people being better at me now was me not being good at it anymore. But that's not true. I didn't learn how to practice. I didn't learn how to hone my skills because I just relied so much on just my natural giftings starting in sixth grade. And then the more I matured, the more I was just kind of naturally maturing in that, and didn't ever put really any hard work into it unless it was basketball season and they made you. I had to go to practice. And so the next thing in my life that I was kind of naturally gifted at, and guys, like, this is not me up here trying to like tell you all of the wonderful things about Kara. This is me just trying to be vulnerable and share with you how God's currently working in my life. But the other thing I was kind of naturally gifted at since really, really young was singing. My mom dressed me up as Shirley Temple, and I did this for a church event. I pretended to be Shirley Temple. That's why I had the so short skirt. I was pretending to be a little girl, but I wasn't that little of a girl. And I got all kinds of praise and accolades. I could stay on key. I could find harmonies pretty well. Thank you for growing up Church of Christ with no instruments. And it was easy for me to be up in front of others. And got a lot of praise and attention. And when others grew in their voice and started putting in the work, I continued to lean on my natural talent. You seeing a theme? When I was passed up and other people were chosen for solos, or I went to a college that had a really well-renowned choir, and that you like had to get selected to go on winter choir tour, and I didn't get selected. I just decided I internalized that and processed that as, well, I'm just not good at this anymore, or I'm not as good at other people as other people, so I'm not going to try. But I didn't learn how to learn how to be better at something. I just, when it got hard, when it got tough, I just quit. So now, here I am, 38 years old, and I'm noticing my willingness to be a leader. I'm noticing my willingness to teach, to speak. And it's a gifting that I feel like, you know, God gives us all different kinds of gifts. It's a gift that I'm learning how to lean into, and I'm learning to not seek attention from it, just doing it for attention and for praise, but for trying to hone that into it being something that glorifies God. And there's things about it that I'm not super good at, like knowing how to do notes. Like, this is something like this, you guys are an active part of seeing me struggle. Like, I don't know how, I know what I want to say, but I don't know how to write the notes and not have to read from the notes. Does that make sense? So this is like totally, like what I'm talking about today, like this is real life application laid out in front of you right now. I'm having to learn how to do this. And today is a product of me learning how to learn. That's what I'm trying to say. Like the woman at the well, I am doing a hard thing, and I'm trying to tell others about Jesus, the Jesus that I've encountered. And like Jonah, I'm in the middle of a hard task, and I'm learning about telling others about Jesus. And like Jesus, I feel alone up here in my struggle, and often want somebody else to do this, or I don't want to do what I feel like God's asking me to do. But I know that others may have an opportunity or a glimpse of Jesus if I just do the will of God, you know? Like, it's my hope and it's my prayer that my sacrifice to God through being a vessel in this moment is that you guys feel encouraged to go from here today, and whatever current struggle you're in, whatever struggles you had in the past you're willing to learn from, and whatever struggle you know you're walking into, you know that it's not all for naught. That God can, at the end of all of that, God can be glorified, and that God can move and be seen. It's just an act, it's just takes part of, it's just us being willing to let him do it. I love you guys. Thank you so much for letting me, for being a safe place for me to do this. Like, this is, my family. And you guys, you guys are just precious to me, and so thank you for letting me tell you about what I'm amped up about.